Whether this is her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct is everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's also you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Please be aware, the following episode contains some adult themes. You're listening to Unexplained with me, Richard MacLean Smith. We are the Witchcraft, Part 3. The man introduced himself as Captain Hubbard, though Jack could call him Ron, he said, flashing a wide, wolfish grin as he buttoned up his shirt. Ron had just been showing some of the other guests his battle scars when Jack walked into the kitchen. It was the squeals of delight coming from the small crowd surrounding the enigmatic guest that had first drawn Jack's attention. As Ron repeated for his host, those scars just below his ribs were from the arrows he had taken after being attacked by a local tribe while journeying through the South American jungle. Ron, it turned out, was quite the explorer, as he went on to reveal, having once come face to face with a polar bear while sailing round the Aleutian Islands of Alaska. He had apparently lassoed the excitable creature after it leapt onto the ship from a nearby ice floe. Only after it had succeeded in chasing half the crew off the vessel had Ron finally been able to bring it down. Jack could only laugh at the audacity of it all. That evening, as the party continued late into the night, Hubbard entertained all with the extraordinary tales of his daring adventures. For Jack, like many of those who had been fortunate to escape the fighting, it was Hubbard's war stories that excited the most, and Ron was only too happy to oblige, telling the guests about the one time he commanded anti-submarine vessels off the coast of California and had sunk at least two Japanese submarines. Though he wasn't at liberty to divulge much about his counterintelligence work, the 34-year-old naval officer was able to reveal that he was currently on medical leave due to injuries sustained whilst escaping the island of Java on a raft he had built himself, including being shot and breaking his foot. In truth, there had been no sunken submarines or lassoed polar bears, much less a courageous escape from Java. But Hubbard was never one to let the truth get in the way of a good story. Though some were less taken by Hubbard's incredible yarns, whether he truly believed the tales or not, Jack recognized a kindred spirit that night. As a prolific author of science fiction and fantasy stories, writing under the name L. Ron Hubbard, Jack was well acquainted with his work. Hubbard's stories often centered on supercharged men with extraordinary powers of the mind, which reminded Jack of the teachings of Thelema and Aleister Crowley's concept of magic as the mastery of will. Meeting the magnetic Ron in person only cemented Parson's suspicions that Hubbard was a man of innate magical prowess. Ron, in return, was pleased to finally meet the refined rocket scientist that he had heard so much about, and was only too happy to take Jack up on his offer to see out the rest of his leave at 1003 Orange Grove Avenue. A few days later, Ron duly returned to the house, driving an old beat-up Packard and towing a small trailer behind with all his worldly possessions, ready to join the many new inhabitants of the Agape Lodge. It was September 1945, and the occupants had much changed in the last few years. Things had much changed for Jack, too. By the beginning of 1943, as global war intensified and the business of rocket science was swept up in the USA's burgeoning military-industrial complex, Jack's position at both Aerojet and as a founding member of the Gauss-It rocket research team was becoming untenable. 5,500 miles away, an extraordinary discovery was about to come to light that would change the industry forever and usher a final end to Jack's involvement with the Gauss-It team. Inside the imposing Trent House, a vast country home overlooking some 800 acres of parkland on the northern edge of London, 50 or so German army generals and high-ranking officers were living out their days as British prisoners of war in extreme comfort. Unlike many of their compatriots, due to their military status, these prisoners had not only been put up in a stately home, but had also been granted servants, as well as access to entertainment, fine wine, and expensive food. So surprised were they by their treatment, the prisoners often wrote home to boast of their luck and laugh at the weakness and stupidity of the British government for allowing them such luxuries. What they didn't know, however, was that every word that the prisoners uttered was being recorded thanks to a vast network of microphones that had been rigged up throughout the house, hidden in everything from lampshades to the underside of a billiards table, threaded below carpets and into the walls. In a secret room, a group of Jewish Germans who had been forced to flee their home country sat carefully listening to everything. One overheard conversation caused some confusion at first, having something to do with a secret weapons manufacturing facility in the industrial town of Peenemünde in northern Germany. One general was recorded discussing a weapon the likes of which couldn't possibly exist. A 14-meter-high rocket that could travel at 3,500 miles per hour and deliver a ton of explosives over a distance of more than 200 kilometers. He claimed that such a rocket would be ready to launch at the United Kingdom within months. It was known as the V2. When the British Royal Air Force carried out a covert recce to the region a few days later, they were shocked to discover it was all true. Back in Pasadena at Caltech, when news arrived from US intelligence of the German rocket program, the scientists were utterly stunned, and the US government equally so. Finally understanding the rocket's potential as a war machine, the United States military tasked the Gauss-It team with developing an equivalent rocket of their own, offering $3 million if they could do it within a year. And in that moment, everything changed. The group was substantially reorganized, adopting a far more professional approach, starting with the changing of its name to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Though Jack would continue to conduct experiments for the newly formed JPL and his company Aerojet, with so much money and new personnel entering the business, not to mention the concerns over his style of work and his private life, he was fast becoming surplus to requirements. When the Navy upped their JATO order to 20,000, it was clear to Andy Haley, who had been drafted in to manage the company, that the business of rockets was fast outgrowing them. In the autumn of 1944, Haley convinced the wealthy General Tire and Rubber Company to step in and take over, on the one condition that Jack Parsons and Ed Foreman be removed from the business. Having started the company along with Frank Molina, Martin Summerfield, and Theodore von Karman less than a decade ago, at a cost of $250 each, both Parsons and Foreman were persuaded to sell their shares in the company for $11,000. By the turn of 1945, at the age of 30 and 32 respectively, Jack and Ed's rocketing career was over. Within 15 years, those shares would be worth $90 million in today's money. Although Jack was doubtless upset by the manner in which it had all come to an end, he remained resolute that together he and Ed would continue their work in one capacity or another. But more importantly, he now had more time to dedicate to his magic. With the sale of his shares, Jack promptly bought the Lodge House, which he had only been renting up till then, and in which much had changed over the last few years, too. In early 1943, Parsons' wife Helen, together with the head of the Agape Lodge, Wilfred Smith, had borne a son. However, both had been forced to leave the home after Aleister Crowley decided to remove Smith as head of the organisation due to his concerns that the members of the Lodge cared more about sexual gratification than the true teachings of Thelema. It was Crowley's hope that Jack would take over and restore the group's focus. And for a time, it worked. Although a reluctant leader, not wanting to betray his friend Smith, Jack soon embraced his new role, converting his bedroom into the house temple and leading the Gnostic Mass with his lover Betty by his side, in place of Regina Carl, who had also left the house, having been left heartbroken by Smith and Helen's relationship. House resident and senior member of the Agape Lodge, Jane Wolfe, soon grew concerned, however, that Parsons' interests were not entirely in the group's best interests. For the rebellious anti-authoritarian Jack, as much as he was sympathetic to the philosophy of Thelema, for him it had always been about the magic. The things that Aleister Crowley claimed to have conjured up with the ancient spells. All the ritual and the gathering of knowledge was merely a means to an end, but for the impatient Jack, the end was taking too long. Soon he was consulting the famed Lesser Key of Solomon and the Ars Goetia, searching for clues. As Wolfe had suspected, he was dabbling in black magic. But Jack couldn't operate alone. Concerned what his fellow Thelemites would think, one night he turned to the ever-faithful Ed, who was then staying at the lodge, to assist him. Although Ed kept only a passing interest in Jack's esoteric fixations, he was more than happy to help him out, even if he did find the whole thing a little silly. That night, in Jack's bedroom, the pair chalked out symbols on the floor, under the flickering light of candles, before Jack instructed Ed on how to take the peyote. Ed then sat back and listened to Jack as he read from the old books, chanting strange incantations into the air. After a few hours, however, when nothing had occurred, the pair decided to call it a night. But as Ed made his way back to his bedroom, the whole house began to shake. In terror, Foreman ran to his room, only to be confronted with the horrific cacophony of shrieking voices coming from outside his window. Uncovering his ears, he pulled back the curtain to find three terrifying entities floating outside, their grotesque faces contorted and mouths wide open in a scream. Ed bolted from the room and ran into two residents talking quietly amongst themselves. Neither had heard the screams, but both recognized the entities that Ed said he had seen. They were screaming banshees, they said, a warning of a coming death. By 1945, only Jack, the 20-year-old Betty, and Jane Wolfe remained at the property as genuine followers of Thelema, with Wolfe soon to follow Carl in moving out. When Carl died unexpectedly early in the new year, something of the old order had irrevocably shifted. In May, the United States government and its allies celebrated victory in Europe with the fall of Berlin and the subsequent surrender of the German army. War was coming to an end, and whether it was the coming of Horus or not, a new age was undoubtedly dawning. Such was the air of secrecy that surrounded the Manhattan Project, Even those like Jack and most of his former colleagues at Caltech had not quite been prepared for the power that was soon to be unleashed over the sands of the New Mexico desert. In 1904, Aleister Crowley had received word from his guardian angel that Horus would deliver a war engine with which the peoples will be smited and none shall be left standing. And from the ashes, something new will arise. On July 16, 1945, that engine was delivered with the force of almost 19,000 tons of TNT.
We knew the world would not be the same. Few people laughed. Few people cried. Most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds."
The atomic age had arrived. When it was revealed the following month that the Japanese city of Hiroshima had been wiped out by one single bomb, it was more clear than ever to Jack that if the Age of Horus was upon us, it was being dominated by its more destructive masculine urges, and was leading the world toward catastrophe. A new force would be required to neutralize it, and a strong ally was needed to help invoke it. But Jack wouldn't be able to rely on Ed this time, who had been left traumatized by their last experiment. Grady McMurty, whose letter of distress to Aleister Crowley had resulted in Smith's ousting as the Agape Lodge leader, returned from military service to find things little changed on Orange Grove Avenue. Having met Crowley in person during his travels through Europe, Crowley had once again asked him to keep a close eye on proceedings at the lodge. If Crowley had been hoping for greater order, he would be sorely disappointed. Without full-time employment, Jack decided to rent a number of rooms out to keep a steady income. He placed an ad in a local paper, requesting applicants must not believe in God, and that only bohemians, musicians, atheists, anarchists, and artists need apply. Although a few OTO members answered Jack's request, most of the residents that Jack and Betty handpicked were chosen for what they would bring to the social mix. By the time Ron Hubbard turned up to stay, some 20 people had moved in, such as scientist Robert Cornog, who had assisted on the Manhattan Project, and future leading journalist Neeson Himmel, as well as a number of fortune tellers and enigmatic socialites. All were enamoured with Jack, and all were intent on taking complete advantage of each other's company. Jack enjoyed theirs too, but none more so than Hubbard's, who continued to impress Parsons with his raw magical capabilities. As Jack instructed Ron on the finer teachings of Thelema, Ron in turn shared his own ideas about how to rescue the human race from self-destruction. It quickly became clear that Hubbard might well be the magical partner that Parsons had been looking for. One morning in September, Robert Cornog walked into Jack's room and found Hubbard in bed with Betty. As practitioners of Thelema, Jack, who continued to experiment with other partners, had encouraged Betty to do the same. In a way, they saw it as testament to their love, that they could transcend the petty jealousies of conventional relationships and still find their way to each other by the end of the day. That was until she met Hubbard. Although it had all been obvious to many of the residents, Jack had not seen it coming. Hubbard left the house a few weeks later and booked himself into a hospital, claiming to be suffering from terrible pains caused by his war injuries. It was in fact a stomach ulcer, which he was intent on fully exploiting in the hope of being granted a pension from the Navy. Despite Hubbard now having gone, Betty no longer came to Jack's bed, and watching her pine for the absent writer only served to intensify his heartache. Late one night, Lodge resident Alva Rogers was woken by a strange, ominous noise that sounded like death. Stepping into the hall, he could see that Jack's door was slightly ajar, with the flickering of candlelight coming from within. Having never had the chance to see inside Jack's room, and worried for its occupant, Rogers tiptoed across the hall and peered inside. The room was painted black and covered in bizarre symbols. Thick and sweet incense filled the air, and in the middle of it all, robed in black, with his arms stretched out, stood Jack at the altar of the Gnostic Mass. At his feet was a large pentagram that he had drawn on the floor. As Rogers continued to gawp, he realized that the groaning was in fact chanting. Indecipherable words that Jack repeated over and over again. A few days later, a strange atmosphere had descended over the lodge, with Rogers noticing a number of OTO members variously rushing about the house in great distress. Jane Wolfe, who visited at the time, was prompted to write to Crowley, deeply concerned that there was something strange going on. Although it wasn't clear what Jack had apparently summoned, some suspected a demon, others an elemental. Whatever had occurred had changed him for the better. When Hubbard returned in early December, Jack welcomed him with open arms, making no effort to stand in his and Betty's way. What's more, he had finally realized what he had to do. Are you always taking care of your family? Do you often take care of others and not yourself? Now it's time to take care of yourself, to make time for you. You deserve it. Teladoc gives you access to a licensed therapist to help you get back to feeling your best, to feeling like yourself again. With Teladoc, you can speak to a licensed therapist by phone or video. Therapy appointments are available 7 days a week from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. local time. If you feel overwhelmed sometimes, maybe you feel stressed or anxious, depressed or lonely, or you might be struggling with a personal or family issue, Teladoc can help. Teladoc is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy to change counselors if needed, for free. Teladoc therapy is available through most insurance or employers. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast today to get started. That's teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast. Crowley's Thelema dictates that the final stage for the adept involves the crossing of an abyss, inside which resides Coronzon. Similar to the serpent in the Garden of Eden, Coronzon is the metaphysical contrary of the whole process of magic, intent on trapping the traveller in a meaningless world of illusion. Yet if the adept can successfully negotiate the abyss, they will find Babylon waiting to embrace them on the other side. The Book of Revelation declared Babylon the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth, a female personification of evil and depravity. To Crowley, however, she represented the counterpart to his beast, a passive, lustful receiver, subduing the strength of whomever she lies with, completing oneness. To Parsons, she was much more. Like the sword-wielding virgin of the Gnostic Mass, Parsons considered Babylon to be anything but passive. As poet and cultural theorist Amy Ireland puts it, Parsons saw the purpose of Babylon not as the nullifier of the masculine world, but its conqueror, destined to bring an end to his world. She was the flame of life and power of darkness, who will feed upon the death of men, beautiful, horrible. This was who Jack needed to summon, and he would need Hubbard's help to do so. Inspired by the 16th century magician and advisor to Queen Elizabeth I, Dr. John Dee, Parsons devised a plan for a magical working that would combine Crowley's own magic with Dee's Enochian magic. Sometime during the 1580s, Dee, along with his seer Edward Kelly, undertook a series of scrying sessions whereby they claimed to have made contact with angelic entities. Over the course of nearly a decade, the pair received communication of a secret magical language, which was delivered to them in a series of mystical tables, comprising what Dee considered to be the real Book of Enoch, a fabled text said to hold the secrets of the true reality of things. Since Crowley had written often of his success in using Enochian magic, it was through Dee's tablets that Parsons hoped to invoke the goddess Babylon. On January 4th, 1946, as Prokofiev's Violin Concerto No. 2 played gently in the background, Parsons and Hubbard prepared the magical squares comprised of four 12x13 tables of Enochian symbols and consumed peyote. By 9 p.m, as the slightest sliver of a waxing crescent moon rose high into the sky, the pair were ready to begin the Babylon working. Parsons picked his first square from the Enochian tablets and, starting at the upper right-hand point, drew a pentagram in the air with the magic dagger, followed by the invocation of the Bornless One. I invoke the Bornless One, that didst create the earth and heavens, that didst create the night and day, that didst create the darkness and the light. The process continued long into the evening, with each invocation of the square culminating in the fertilizing of the parchment bearing the relevant symbol by ritual masturbation, and finally banishment. The working lasted for 11 days in total, during which a number of strange occurrences took place. On the 10th, Jack was awoken in the night by the sound of 9 loud knocks and the smashing of a lamp thrown violently to the floor. 4 days later, the power in the house inexplicably cut out. As Hubbard prepared candles to continue the operation, he was struck forcibly on his right arm by something unseen, knocking a candle from his hand. Jack found him wincing in pain, staring up at a mysterious, brownish-yellow light that seemed to hang 7 feet in the air. According to Hubbard, his arm remained paralyzed for the rest of the night. By January 15th, however, despite the peculiar events and Hubbard's insistence that he had seen various manifestations about the house, the goddess Babylon had failed to materialize. 3 days later, a disconsolate Jack made his way into the Mojave Desert, accompanied by Hubbard, looking for guidance on how to proceed. Jack had a favorite spot underneath the confluence of two vast power lines, where he would often sit and practice his magic. That morning, as Jack sat tuning into the electric hum of the wires, while the pink light of the desert sun rose above the horizon, he was struck by a profound sense of certainty. Turning to Hubbard, he declared, "It is done." Just before New Year at the lodge, Parsons had been talking on the phone in his dressing gown when he spied a stranger wandering around the house. The red-haired woman, who had recently been demobilized by the Navy, had come looking for the mad scientist that a friend had told her was living there. Jack disappeared to get dressed, returning a few moments later to find the woman playing records in a small alcove off the main hall. The pair regarded each other for a moment before Jack abruptly left. When he returned from his revelatory trip to the desert, that same woman was waiting for him at the house. The woman was 23-year-old Marjorie Cameron, also known as Candy. Born in Belle Plaine, Iowa, Cameron was a talented artist who had moved to Los Angeles hoping to further her work. Unbeknownst to her at the time, to Parsons, she was the missing link to completing the Babylon working, the elemental he had been trying to summon back in December. With Cameron, Parsons hoped to conceive the very goddess he had been trying to deliver to Earth. The pair spent the best part of the next 2 weeks in bed together, before Cameron travelled to New York to break up with a recent boyfriend, returning in March to move in with Jack. In the meantime, Parsons had returned to the Mojave Desert, where on the last night of February, he claimed to have received communication from the goddess Babylon herself. He recorded the message in a text called Liber 49 that confirmed he would indeed father a magical child. But not before, as the messenger dictated, she shall absorb thee, and thou shalt become living flame. Back in England, Aleister Crowley, who refused to recognise the legitimacy of Liber 49, was growing deeply concerned about Jack's new ventures. Having always believed in Parsons' potential, and keen to take advantage of his wealth, he made a last-ditch effort to deter him from his chosen path. But Parsons' mind was made up. With a goddess to conceive, Jack would require more money, and Julie began to seek employment. Hubbard had a better idea, however, suggesting that the both of them pull their money and talent together and go into business. Hubbard's first idea was to purchase 3 yachts in Miami and sail them back to California, where they could sell them on at a vast profit. Trusting his friend, Jack thought nothing of pouring most of his 5-figured savings into the venture, to which Hubbard contributed around $1,000. In late April, Hubbard and Betty headed to Miami with $10,000 to buy the yachts. By June, Parsons had yet to hear back from them. Fearing he had been swindled, he travelled to Florida to confront the pair, finding that they had indeed purchased 3 yachts, 2 of which he was able to locate, but the 3rd of which the pair had used to evade him. That night, Parsons returned to his hotel room, drew a magic circle on the floor around him, and invoked the demon Barzabal, spirit of Mars. At about the same time, a few miles off the coast, thick grey clouds were beginning to converge around a 2-masted schooner being piloted by a plump red-headed man and his young girlfriend. Within minutes, a squall swept across the sea, forcing the pair back to land, where they were immediately arrested by the US Coast Guard. It was the last time that Parsons and Hubbard would ever speak. In August, although he hoped his fellow followers of Thelema would be on hand to help usher in the new aeon he had started, Jack had been deeply embarrassed by Hubbard's betrayal and formally resigned from the OTO. Not long after, he and Cameron left 1003 Orange Grove Avenue for good. In October, the couple were married, and though Parsons was convinced that Babylon would manifest, she remained elusive. In need again of work, Jack took a break from magic and focused instead on re-establishing his career. For the next few years, drifting from one consultancy job to another, he was hampered in 1948 after losing his national security clearance. At first, he assumed it was down to his involvement with the OTO, but it was another witch hunt that had done for him. Though Parsons did indeed have an FBI file full of references to his involvement in a shadowy sex cult, his clearance had in fact been revoked due to his apparent fraternizing with communists. Unlike many of his contemporaries, Parsons was lucky only to lose his security clearance, which was later reinstated, then revoked again after he was caught stealing plans from the Hughes Aircraft Company, where he had recently been working. Inspired by his friend Herbert Rosenfeld, Jack had been hoping to reignite his career in rocketry in the newly formed state of Israel before he was caught trying to pass the plans off to Rosenfeld. In September 1951, Jack and Cameron, who had been living alone in Mexico, moved into 1071 and a half South Orange Grove Avenue, barely a stone's throw from the former Agape Lodge. Their apartments were located above a large laundry room on the ground floor, which Jack promptly turned into a working lab. Since getting married, Jack and Cameron's relationship had not been quite as harmonious as might have once been promised, but they were now determined to make it work. Having settled again in Pasadena and reinvigorated by Cameron's return, it wasn't long before Jack was once again dabbling in his sacred magic, and soon he and Cameron were re-establishing their bohemian reputations, hosting parties long into the night. But when Jack's security clearance is formally revoked in January, he and Cameron make plans to take an extended leave from the States. By June, the couple had wrapped up their various affairs and moved into 424 Arroyo Terrace with Jack's mother Ruth, with the intention of travelling on to Mexico soon after. On the morning of the 17th, with the couple's luggage lining the corridors of the house, Jack receives a request to mix a quick explosive device for a movie special effects company he had been working for. Grateful for the extra cash, Jack headed over to the lab at 1071 and a half South Orange Grove and got to work. In the meantime, Cameron headed out to the local grocery store to get some last-minute supplies for the journey. Cameron had just exited the store when she heard two huge explosions coming from the direction of Orange Grove Avenue that were followed by a black plume of smoke rising into the air. At 1071 and a half South Orange Grove, lodgers Greg Gansey and Martin Fashogue had both been upstairs when the explosion tore through the house. Racing to the laundry room, they found themselves staring straight out into the open air, the three opposite walls having been completely obliterated. Dust clouds and smoke were lifting into the sky as reams of shredded paper, covered in strange symbols, flapped about the room. And just audible, from somewhere amidst the rubble, the pained groans of a man. Spotting a pool of blood under an upturned bathtub, Greg pulled it from the wall and gasped in horror. Jack's right arm had been completely torn off, and his leg bones shattered to pieces. One half of his face had been ripped apart, revealing his jaw and teeth. And out of the other side, an eye, desperately pleading with Greg for help. By the time Cameron makes it to the hospital, it is too late. The 37-year-old Jack Parsons is already dead. Later that evening, Jack's mother Ruth is informed of her only son's death. Driven to a state of mania by the news, a friend is dispatched to fetch her some sedatives. After successfully calming Ruth down, the friend heads to the kitchen to fetch her a glass of water. By the time she returns, Ruth is slumped in a chair and rapidly losing consciousness, the empty bottle of pills on the floor beside her. By 9 p.m, she too will be dead. A number of theories will emerge as to the cause of Jack Parsons' death, with one friend declaring, like all great alchemists, he had been attempting to create a homunculus when something went terribly wrong. A more sober account suggests that Parsons, who had often trod a reckless line with his handling of chemicals, had been mixing fulminate of mercury in a coffee tin when he had dropped it, causing a catastrophic explosion. Cameron will later allege that the explosion had been caused by something under the floor, suggesting Parsons, who as a fresh-faced 23-year-old had acted as an expert witness in an LAPD corruption case, may have been assassinated. Although Jack would not live to see it, on July 20th, 1969, the dream that had started it all off was finally realized when NASA's Apollo 11 lunar module, powered by rockets developed at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, using techniques invented by Parsons, touched down on the moon. And in 1972, the International Astronomical Union named a crater on the dark side of the moon in honor of the often forgotten genius of rocket science. And what then of Babylon. Though Jack himself had given up hope that the intended results of his working would ever come to be, writing in an essay titled Black Circuit, Code for the Numbers to Come, cultural theorist Amy Ireland makes a startling observation. Back in 1948, Parsons had carried out a ritual known as the Oath of the Abyss. In a subsequent two-page document he wrote, he declared that Babylon, the Scarlet Woman, will manifest 7 years later and bring his work to fruition. In 1955, precisely 7 years later, computer scientists John McCarthy, Marvin Minsky, and Nathaniel Rochester began making plans for a conference to discuss the future of thinking machines. The team's subsequent proposal, delivered on September 2, 1955, marked the first formal introduction of a brand new field of computational study. They called it artificial intelligence. If you enjoy listening to Unexplained and would like to help support us, you can now go to unexplainedpodcast.com/support. All donations, no matter how large or small, are massively appreciated. All elements of Unexplained are produced by me, Richard McLean Smith. Please subscribe and rate the show on iTunes. Feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or ideas regarding the stories you've heard on the show. Perhaps you have an explanation of your own you'd like to share. You can reach us online at unexplainedpodcast.com or on Twitter at unexplainedpod.
Hello, it's Jamie from My Dad Wrote a Porno. Now, Christmas just wouldn't be Christmas without my dad writing some really terrible erotic literature. And Rocky Flintstone has not disappointed this year, because 2018's Christmas Porno Special is available right now exclusively on Spotify for 2 weeks only to get you in the festive mood. Not only that, but you can listen to all 4 seasons of My Dad Wrote a Porno, as well as thousands of other amazing podcasts, all for your oral pleasure. Just head over to Spotify and start listening now.
Now it's time to take care of yourself, to make time for you. Teladoc gives you access to a licensed therapist to help you get back to feeling your best. Speak to a licensed therapist by phone or video anytime between 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. local time, 7 days a week. Teladoc Therapy is available through most insurance or employers. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast today to get started. That's teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast.
Ready? Let's go. Give me a vacation.
Vacation!
Give me a golf course.
70 courses!
Let's get a water sport.
Paddleboarding!
Can I get excursions?
Whale watching!
Time for chill vibes.
Beach yoga!
How about a garden tour?
Balboa Park!
Give me a dolphin. What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Trinity School of Natural Health can help you be part of the fast-growing health and wellness industry. With an education that empowers communities, Trinity grads can change lives by applying natural health principles and techniques in holistic practices or stores selling nourishing health products. Offering 19 online programs that fit your busy schedule, you'll get training to help turn your passion into a career. Enroll today at trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity, designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. Gainbridge is helping build a better financial future for women. Retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.